Taras Buyuk's special mission is the breakup of the Russian Federation, a project that doesn't seem quite so far-fetched after the Prigozhin mutiny and Putin's endless aggression that is exhausting Russia's military and economic reserves. Taras is a civil society activist and political strategist who believes that Ukraine's Maidan revolution, in which he participated, saved not only Ukraine, but also Europe. Today we'll be discussing the threat from a resurgent Russia and the history of imperial expansion that sits behind it. Can Ukraine stand for freedom and struggle against renewed Russification of its peoples, hold the line in Europe between freedom and authoritarianism, between the rule of law and unimaginable barbarism? Can Ukraine's experience even help revitalize the idea of democracy and help us to become more resilient in the face of creeping nepotism, corruption, oligarchy, and aggressive autocrats? Welcome to Silicon Curtain. Please like, subscribe, and comment on the videos. It really does help them to perform in YouTube, and it helps, of course, new people to discover the fantastic guests that we feature. Please also consider buying me a coffee, but before you do that, check out the validated Ukrainian charities that are listed in the video description. They do incredible work, and it's never been more important than it is now to support Ukraine to remain resilient in the face of Russian aggression. Taras, welcome to the channel.
Thank you for the warm presentation and for your support of Ukraine.
Well, let's dive into your motivations. I mean, it's quite clear why. I think everyone understands why Ukraine is defending itself, why Ukraine needs to return to its sovereign territories. And we've covered that on the channel a lot. I think it's well understood. I think the myth of Crimea and especially Donbass being somehow Russian and not Ukrainian, I think we've also tackled that a lot, and that it's worth seeing these people as hostages as opposed to people wanting to return to the Russian world. But you have this other idea that actually to achieve all these things and to be secure in future, the Russian Empire, the Russian Federation needs to collapse. What's the motivation behind that idea for you?
I will tell about this from my personal approach. So when the big war in Ukraine had begun, I stayed in Kyiv. I was volunteering, helping the army. Then I joined local formation of so-called voluntary paramilitary formation, basically territorial defense of the Kyiv city. We were basically preparing for the guerrilla, for the partisan war in the city in case Russians invade the city, like, you know, from digging trenches to undergoing military training. So fortunately, Russians failed to invade Kyiv. But by April, May, it was clear for me that it will be extremely difficult for Ukraine to win this war in a linear way. So we have to use some kind of asymmetric approach. This is when I learned about so-called Free Nations of Post-Russia Forum, which was held, the first event was held in Warsaw on May 8 in 2022. I have decided to join it, and I like this idea, and I joined the organization committee, and we have organized many forums since then. But the main idea is that however this war ends, if Russia remains within its current borders, sooner or later, it will attack somebody again. It can be Ukraine, it can be Georgia, Armenia, who are now most likely will get out of the Russian sphere of influence. It can be one of the NATO countries. We don't know what do we expect from Russia. But the ground base is that if Russia remains within its current borders, it's only a question of time. Because, you know, the essence of Russia is its empire. As long as it exists, it is a threat. The second idea behind this this forum, these events we are organizing, is that we want to approach this problem from the win-win perspective. I mean, it can sound paradoxical because, you know, for me as a Ukrainian, after seeing what Russians have done to my country, to wish them well. But we cannot simply, you know, eliminate 140 million people. I mean, they will not disappear. And, you know, if in long prospect we keep them as they are today, which is basically, you know, with this savages culture, I would say, it will only return with, they will only return to us with more wars. So the idea is to have this win-win scenario. In care, we call the process the Russian decolonization process. It will give first, well, obviously this is a win for Ukraine. This is a win for the West because the West will achieve possibility. Well, because Russia will not exist anymore as geopolitical threat for the West, and the West will achieve a possibility to engage in trade and economic and political relations with the new countries. And ultimately, this is a win for the new potential states of the post-Russia, which will have chance at last to build normal, civilized, democratic countries on their soils and not to pay huge contributions to Moscow. First, to sustain Putin's corrupt criminal regime, and second, to support his imperialistic wars. So imagine, you know, if all these resources stayed in those regions, how rich they would have been.
And that's the territory of Russia, and I think the historian Alexander Itkind has called it a sort of internal colonization, and it's a difficult one, I think, for a lot of Western minds to get their heads around, because we're used to the seaborne empires of something like Britain, and that decolonization process, as messy as it was, and some of that mess is still playing out, obviously in Africa and the Middle East. But we imagine that process taking place, and it's in some ways it's slightly easier to make that break, and for the territories that are released from imperial control to regain something of their identity in a contiguous land empire such as Russia is. Is the mechanics of empire far more degrading, let's say, on local cultures in order to conquer that territory? Do you not just assimilate people, but you actually have to downgrade, degrade, destroy, genocide their cultures in order to keep that entity together?
This is exactly the case because the idea of our forum is to bring to get together representatives of those peoples, like captive nations, basically colonized people who were colonized by the Russian Empire on certain stage of the expansion of Moscow Empire then, and who are coming to traveling all around the world and telling directly to the world, my people is being destroyed. Moscow is killing my traditions, my languages, my identity. So this is something that the world doesn't know. And these people, it's not Ukrainians, it's not Westerners who are talking about them, but those are Ichkerians, Tatars, Bashkirs, and so on and so on, who are talking about how they are being colonized. And I mean, this was quite an opening for me because, well, my background is international law, but I was studying always, you know, Western civilization, the European integration, and so on. And it was a big opening for me what is happening on the Russian soil because since I had to engage in this topic, I made some researches. And I know people on the West don't know about this. And that's why we try to broaden this information. And even we have the situation is even much worse with the perception on so-called global South, if we may use this term. When you know, when it's only Western countries are perceived as imperialistic countries. Once upon a time, and Russia is often perceived as a country which is fighting the West. But the case is that it's on the contrary. Today, Russia is de facto the last empire on our planet, and Russia is colonizing other people like it's trying to colonize Ukraine, basically, today, physically by force, and not vice versa.
We see this. I mean, that's to look at the territory of Russia. Of course, Chechnya is an interesting one. Chechnya perhaps is more likely to break away than other regions. You've got Belarus as well, which is it's an unstable autocracy. The only thing propping up essentially is Russian propagandists, sort of, Oman and the sort of the sheer will and violence of the Kremlin. If that was to retreat or be diminished, one could easily imagine Belarus going down the path of Ukraine. It's more difficult, isn't it, to imagine other territories fully going down this route. So do you envisage a highly fragmented entity, but it is still essentially known as Russia? It's just radically decentralized. Or do you think that there is a chance of the emergence of separate nation states? Could that perhaps also lead to other issues, because it's not necessarily the case that these all would become flourishing democracies. You might have lots of small autocracies emerge on the place of one large autocracy.
Absolutely. I'm sure that the process of Russian decolonization or breakup will be extremely complicated. It may have very negative side effects. And this is actually, we always hear when we talk about breakup of Russia, we always hear on the West, no. If we work on this, we may have really serious negative consequences. And that's the point of our events. We are saying that the West should not organize Russian collapse. Russia will fall apart itself, herself, but we have to be ready for this collapse to mitigate all these consequences, like, immigration of huge number of people from Russia, like what is happening to nuclear weapons and so on and so on. So this is the idea of us talking to the West. Don't make the mistake you made in early 1990s when you tried to preserve the Soviet Union. Instead, give these countries a chance. And yes, you mentioned different countries. I agree with you that different countries may choose different path. I'm sure that not all of them will become democratic, but as long as they are autocratic and they do not pose a threat for their neighbors, for the world, I mean, we should be fine with this at least for a while. Let's take, I don't know, let's take Azerbaijan, which is quite an autocracy, but which has good relations with the West. So this could be the case with many new republics of post-Russia. I'm sure that people of Belarus sooner or later will choose democracy. Because, well, this is exactly no very good example of what was happening since 1990s. Basically, Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia had equal chance, to start build new states. We have many countries which chose democracy, which chose EU and NATO, with three Baltic countries joining the EU and NATO. We have Ukraine, which chose democracy and now has to fight for it. And I'm sure it was a correct choice because, well, obviously life is much better than in Russia and Belarus. On the contrary, we see Belarus where civil society, where people used to, well, for quite a long time, struggle for their democracy until they were pretty much destroyed after following the 2020 elections. But I'm sure the spirit, because we communicate with Belarusians, many of them had to leave the country, many of them are in prison now. I'm sure the spirit of Belarusians is still pro-democracy, and sooner or later they will return to the democratic path. But if we are talking about Russia, which had the same chance to become a democratic country. You remember, everyone believed in Democrat Yeltsin, in reformer Putin, in innovative leader Medvedev. But somehow everything failed. Everyone was doing this so-called reload policies and trying to support democracy, not seeing that autocracy, like no, no, not only autocracy, but dictatorship is being established. And Putin was quite open about it. He clearly said that collapse of the USSR was the greatest geopolitical catastrophe, that we should return old lands. He was talking about it everywhere. And the West, well, including Ukraine, continued to trade with him, to keep relations, believing in democracy in Russia. It simply doesn't work this way. So I hope now the world realizes at last that we cannot believe in new Democrats, in new liberals on the Russian soil, as long as it's kept together. It's only countries apart who can build, if not democracies, then at least countries which can lead, which can exist as civilized neighbors with one another.
There's lots of interesting questions come from there. But the first one I want to do is to close out the idea of imperial mindset. First of all, we'll come to this in a minute, because the sort of 9th of May Victory Day parades is quite an interesting sort of lens to look at in terms of looking at the imperial mindset. But there are other events unfolding at the moment. We are seeing tremendous and extremely violently suppressed demonstrations in Tbilisi in Georgia. And it's become increasingly apparent that the government, which to an extent, over the last couple of years, has played that democratic game. It has put on the clothes of a democracy. It has said it's pro-EU and that it's moving towards European integration, etc. It's been making all the right noises, and to an extent, it has worked. A little bit like the hybrid informational autocracy that Putin managed to build until 2012. I think after 2012, the costume started to slip away, and you saw what entity it really was. That's now happening in Georgia, and it seems to be very much a puppet regime of the Kremlin, and that facade is becoming increasingly difficult to maintain that it isn't. Do you see, as long as the Russian Empire exists on the territory of the Russian Federation, you will see it trying to interfere in other states' affairs in the former Soviet territories, both those that constituted the Imperial Russian territories before 1917, and also those that formed part of the USSR, by extension, those states that are now within NATO and within the European Union.
Absolutely. I mean, this was the essence of Russia. It was doing it since basically the collapse of the USSR, but I would say more since Putin came to power. I mean, his ideology was returning former Soviet countries back to Russia. Now, not anymore to Soviet countries. Yes, this could have been, some form of union, but they would be under total Russian control. And Belarus is a perfect example here. De jure, they are a separate country, sovereign country with their own president, but de facto, they are fully, absolutely controlled by Moscow, by Russia. And this was the aim of Putin to keep this control over different countries, whether it's, I mean, Belarus is quite an extreme example of how it's controlled. But in Georgia, yes, they may simply manage to support pro-Russian government. Which yes, pretended to be pro-European, and this is actually one of the reasons why Georgians voted for it. They did not vote it because it was pro-Russian, because they expected. They said, "Okay, Mikhail Saakashvili made many good reforms, but he made many mistakes, and we should choose another European country, a European pro-European, pro-Western party." And this was the way the Bidzina Ivanishvili's team was presenting themselves as they are pro-European but different to Saakashvili, but they will have good relations with Russia. However, all people who were engaged in politics, they have realized that these are pro-Russian government, and today this at last appeared. But from what I see today, there is a great chance for solving these problems because yes, Russia remains very strong, much stronger than we would like it to be. But because of its engagement in Ukraine, because of its war on Ukraine, it cannot control by force all other republics. And we saw what happened in Azerbaijan and Armenia. I mean, the only reason why these countries had conflicts for decades is because of Russia. Russia was trying to control these countries and by sending its forces, so-called peacekeepers. As soon as Russia became much weaker, there are no more Russian peacekeepers anymore. And I'm sure that sooner or later, Azerbaijan and Armenia will reach some civilized peace agreement and will have possibility to develop as a civilized neighbors. The same with Georgia. I mean, I remember very well that one of the first international partners who came to Ukraine to defend Kyiv, like in physical battles, were Georgian soldiers. As a volunteer, I was helping them, like in the very first days of the war. This was a group of experienced Georgian soldiers who were fighting, in Georgia against, Russian attempts to colonize the country. And this is the example of Georgian people who are remaining pro-European, pro-Ukrainian, but who are having Georgia, pro-Russian government. And I'm sure that because of weakened Russia, they will have possibility to remove it sooner or later. We can see the protests, we can see how motivated they are, and I believe in Georgian people removing this pro-Russian government sooner or later.
And an interesting question, I think, arises here because out of all the territories that form the core of the Russian Empire, it's only Ukraine that has been able to roll back Russification, that has been able to develop, I would say, resilience, and also build through numerous revolutions a sense of organic politics, and that, of course, is still developing. And civil society as well. Now, civil society exists in various forms, obviously, everywhere, to a greater or lesser extent. But if you take it, let's say, in Georgia, it's only now starting to develop perhaps some of the cohesion that we saw in Ukraine. Whether it's enough to actually sort of resist the Kremlin's control and coercion is very much an open question. But if democracy is to develop throughout the territory of the ex-USSR, what sort of qualities, what techniques, qualities, methods, and cultures that have developed in Ukraine will be required to sort of, grow and evolve in these other parts in order for their independence to actually be successful?
I would single out two or maybe three such elements. First, as you have mentioned, this is strong civil society, because it was a civil society in Ukraine which basically was most active during both revolutions. Yes, I mean, there were many politicians, but it was not, that some politician came and said, "Let's organize Maidan," and then civil society joined. On the contrary, it was civil society which organized the protests. And I remember very well that first week of the Revolution of Dignity, there were two separate Maidans because civil society did not want to see any political party flags on the central Maidan. And that's why political parties had to stay on the European Square nearby, the Independence Square. Only after this massive attack on the students in late November, political Maidan and civil society Maidan have decided to join, but not under leadership of some politician. I mean, this is the essence of Ukrainian, from the Cossack times, from very old times, when we can elect on Maidan our leader. And this is what was happening during Maidan Nezalezhnosti. We did not have one political leader. We had many people who were, well, I would say, competing for the leadership, and many of whom had quite equal chances. And they were like, their popularity was ch changing during the Maidan. So civil society would be first element to not only, to organize Maidans, but to control authorities in terms of anti-corruption efforts on national level, on local level, to elaborate even draft bills. I remember one of the best initiatives of civil society in Ukraine was establishment of so-called reanimation package of reforms. So it was a group of civil society and think tank leaders who not only were monitoring and criticizing the authorities, but they were elaborating professional bills aimed at, reforming Ukraine, and then which were later approved by the parliament. So they were playing not only passive but very active role in implementing reforms. So then we remember the role of civil society during the first days of the big war, when we immediately organized and provided as much assistance as possible to the army to defend our country. Many members of civil society joined the territorial defense, to join the army. And I think, it was one of the decisive reasons why we managed to survive in the first days of the war. I mean, obviously, our army was the reason number one, but support of the army from civil society, from these horizontal ties, it was hugely important. So I would say this is element number one. The second element is that other countries may use from Ukraine is decentralization. The reform which was conducted since after the Revolution of Dignity, I think it was the most successful reform in Ukraine. So the idea was, to move from the Soviet style of governance when everything was in the country was decided by Kyiv. Basically, all money were flowing to Kyiv, and then, through different mediators, by different shady agreements, going back to the regions and communities. So instead, we have introduced the decentralization reform, according to which much more competences and money were given to local communities. It was a big challenge because it was a question about capacity, anti-corruption, transparency, and so on. But since we managed to unite these two elements, strong local government and strong local society, civil society on local level, we have managed to implement this reform very successfully. I remember that there was even one of the myths about decentralization reform that Ukrainian regions will become more powerful and they will decide to separate from Ukraine. And nothing like this happened. Like, there was not even a hint about this. On the contrary, the mayors have realized that, okay, now we have more money, we have more competences, and if we invest this money properly, we will be reelected. It's that simple. And that's why since 2015, basically, we saw many cities changing. You know, new hospitals were being built, kindergartens, roads, pavements. And this is something people like really saw in practice. I remember the city of Mariupol. I was working there with different projects. I have not been in Mariupol before 2015, but people who lived in Mariupol, who left Mariupol like in 2010 and returned in 2020, they say, wow, these are two different cities. Because, well, the local authorities, international partners invested so much in the city, in the development of the city. So, I mean, for me personally, it was like really heartbreaking to see how this very well-developed city was being destroyed by Russians. It was just really heartbreaking. So, and as a result of these reforms, local authorities started investing in their communities. And if you take results of the 2020 elections, almost all mayors of the biggest regional centers were re-elected because the trust to local authorities was growing tremendously because people saw real changes on the ground as a result of the decentralization reform. So I would say that these two elements are the most important. And the third one is anti-corruption reform. Yes, I know Ukraine is still accused of being like a corrupt country, even though I think this narrative is driven from mainly by Russians and pro-Russian politicians in many countries. Yes, corruption is still a problem in Ukraine, but it's not endemic as it used to be before the Revolution of Dignity. We have managed to create, you know, one of the most powerful system of anti-corruption institutions. Very few countries in the world have them, you know, a National Anti-Corruption Bureau, an Anti-Prosecution Office, Anti-Corruption Prosecution Office, the Anti-Corruption Agency, the Higher Anti-Corruption Court, and so on and so on. Yes, I mean, those institutions are not functioning perfectly, but they are making like really good steps in arresting high-level corrupt officials. So I would say that we have, despite corruption still being a problem, it's not endemic anymore, and we are on the right path to solve this problem.
And it's an interesting question, isn't it? The you've got several things that I think happen simultaneously, and that's why it's so difficult to pick them apart. One is the emergence of local identities. So the ability to have, you know, multiple complex identities. You can be a member of a city, an oblast, a region, but also at the same time, you can be Ukrainian. You can be a member of the whole country. You could, prior to 2014, have sympathies for Russian culture, heritage, etc., and be a Russian speaker as your first language, as well as being Ukrainian. So it's complex, it's nuanced, etc. What, in your view, however, is, you know, how important is it to get these multi-layered, complex identities and nuances going in the territory of Russia? Because there you see its action is often to try and destroy nuance, is to try and label people as being one thing. You can be only this and not the other. And if you don't conform, you are either, you know, tortured, deported, brainwashed, or at worst, you know, killed. That seems to be the mechanic. It's very simplistic what they want to impose. But they do this also on the territory of both, you know, ethnic Russians and those who are the multi-ethnicities within the Russian Empire. So how do you get these sort of multi-layered identities to emerge? And is that also an essential part of the process of organic democratic processes and civil society also emerging?
I think Ukraine is actually a very good example demonstrating, you know, how can you merge national identity and local identity. Because if you look at the opinion polls, if you ask, are you proud to be citizen of your region or of your city, your community, we have like huge support. Yes, like 90% will say I'm proud. But the same question goes, are you proud to be citizen of Ukraine? So, you know, it's about people realizing that only standing, you know, as part of Ukraine, they can keep their identity, because you know this is another idea of decentralization. You know, giving more opportunities to develop on local level, even culturally, giving more possibilities and competences. And that's why people are absolutely happy of being simultaneously, I don't know, citizen of Lviv and citizen of Ukraine, citizen of Crimea and citizen of Ukraine. And actually, you know, this is another good case example of Crimean Tatars, who obviously have their own identity, who were taken out by the Soviet regime of their native land of the Crimea and started returning only in 1990s, finding them now in the minority. But now many of them are fighting in the Ukrainian army for independent Ukraine. Many of them are serving on high level positions in the Ukrainian state. And I mean, even in private conversations with my Crimean Tatar friends, I wouldn't think that, you know, any one of them would think about separating from Ukraine. So this is another great case, because, you know, they see that only as being part of Ukraine, they have possibility to develop their ethnicity, their tradition, their culture, and so on. And not being part of Russia because, well, Russia simply colonizes them and destroys them. So we have many good examples here in Ukraine, how you can combine local identity and ethnic identity and national identity.
Let's turn to the subject then, which is quite topical, which is the role of historical mythology in really sort of binding the Russian people to their autocracy and preventing them from embarking on this process of fragmentation. And the number one mythology, of course, is the Second World War, Russia's heroic role in the Second World War. Of course, many things are conveniently left out of that story. Firstly, that it was the territories of Belarus and Ukraine that obviously underwent the worst impacts and destruction of cities and populations. And we know all the others. Russia would not have achieved any kind of victory in the Second World War if it wasn't for vast, vast supplies of munitions, equipment, tanks, railroad cars, etc., ships from the Allied Western powers. In essence, the USSR was saved by the West. All these things are sort of conveniently left out. But what, in your view, is the role of Victory Day? What is the role of the myths around the Second World War? And how have they gone from potentially being something positive to being entirely toxic within the Russian mythology?
I think this, the mythology you are referring to, and it's, you know, in some cases, it's not even mythology, it's like total lies. So this is something that Russian society is based on, you know, just total lies in which they believe, which propaganda is trying to disseminate, to unite them around this idea. I mean, I can list, you know, just I can speak for hours how many lies is there about Victory Days, which was not, by the way, celebrated for many years. It was introduced much, much later after the Second World War and basically reinvigorated by Vladimir Putin, who saw this holiday, you know, as a kind of the highest point of his dreams, you know, of reuniting Soviet Union, reuniting, like recolonizing former Soviet countries, including Ukraine. And but this is something because, well, you know, they are united around past and they cannot unite around future. I think this is the key problem of Russian society. I mean, obviously, every country has to have memory about its past, have to respect its heroes and so on. But if it's based on total lies, it can result in consequences like this. And this is why we have this support, because why didn't we see Russians protesting against Putin's invasion in the first days of the war? I mean, I was talking to them, I don't have many friends in Russia, but I was trying to talk to some, well, pro-Western, English-speaking, civilized Russians. And even if they would agree that this, like the idea to invade Ukraine was wrong, first, they would not do anything because they were afraid of Putin. And, well, their usual response was, what can we do? So, I mean, My response was like, okay, when we did not like what our president was doing, we get out to Maidan and we kicked our president out of Ukraine. It's that simple. And you just need 0.01% of your population to block Red Square, you know, to block entire Moscow, basically. But this is a different story. And on the other hand, they are united around those myths. You know, they truly believe that Russia invaded Ukraine to save from Nazis, to save Ukraine from NATO. That NATO is going, like, the entire idea is NATO to attack Russia, attack its glorious past, and so on and so on. And that's why, you know, all Russian propaganda machine is working around this Victory Day, Second World War. Well, you know, in Russia, they do not call it Second World War. It's called Great Patriotic War of 1941, 1945, until today. So they, and why they do not recognize the Second World War term? Because, well, de facto, the Second World War was started not only by Hitler, but by Hitler and Stalin, who divided Europe and in September 1939 invaded Poland from the west and from the east. So, obviously, if they talk about those two periods, I mean, they had even joint parades before 1941 of Soviet and Nazi, Soviet regime and Nazi Germany. So, they were simply allies who launched this war. And that's why, you know, they even avoid the term Second World War. They only use the Great Patriotic War of 1941, 1945. I mean, this is what we were taught in school because, well, in independent Ukraine, obviously, it was already different. But in Soviet times, in early 1990s, it was like we had all signs in every community. There was a monument to a memorial to a Great Patriotic War of 1941, 1945. So even plain piece, you know, digits with the years. They were selling this propaganda that it's only black and white. You know, Russia, USSR is always white, and well, the West is very black and very Nazi. And that's why Russia has to save Ukraine from the Nazi Western regime. And that's why many Russians believe in it, because, you know, propaganda is working 24/7 there.
There's another extraordinary historical myth, and it's one that unfortunately is not challenged by very much scholarly research. There are thousands of books, of course, maybe even tens of thousands, about how the British Empire was constituted, how it came to, conquer territories, coerce, control, in some senses, collaborate often with local rulers, and just the mechanics of it, how it worked, and then obviously subsequently how it declined, and slipped away. There's relatively little in comparison written about the process of eastward expansion of the Russian Empire and actually what happened to the peoples, the cultures, the indigenous peoples that were there. The myth has been created by Russia that this was a peaceful empire and that the people who live there in those territories gladly became part of its sort of civilizing process. But that belies, I think, the truth, which is likely that this was an extremely violent, repressive, and genocidal process. How is that myth to be tackled?
You know, we are saying that the only people who were not shocked by what happened in Bucha and other places of, you know, savageous actions of the Russian soldiers, the only people who were not surprised by this are historians who know very well, you know, how Russia has always acted. So this was typical way of the Russian expansion, whether it was Ukraine, whether it was Tatarstan, whether it was Far East, they were coming to new places. They were killing everyone who was against the Russian Empire. In not only them, even civilians, like we saw in Bucha. You know, just civilians, just to demonstrate their power, to demonstrate their strengths, and to make local population be afraid of them. And people who studied history, who studied history of this part of the world, they know this was typical way of how Russia acts until today. I mean, we know very well that Russia had list of people if they invade Kyiv who had to be either executed or imprisoned. So this was like typical, and until today, this is how Russia acts. And this is why we are doing organizing this Free Nations of Post-Russia Forum. We have representatives of those people who are coming to Western countries and talking about their history, How they were colonized, how Russians were coming to them, then Moscovites, later renamed Russians, were coming and basically, you know, destroying population until this population is subjugated. They are telling about what's happening today, how their language, history, tradition, culture is still being destroyed today. Even, you know, the name of their regions, like we can take the one of the far eastern places, Sakha, which is called Yakutia, and many other examples like this. We remember that just, I think it was last year, that Russia was making this advertisement about how different the people have, but they are all Russians, you know, from different regions, different ethnicities, but they all feel Russians. I feel, you know, that Moscow feels the fear of the power of captive nations, and they, you know, pretending to demonstrate that everyone lives in peace with one another, and Russia secures all their political, cultural, social, economic rights, which is obviously not true. And people from these regions, obviously most of them had to leave Russia because of political persecutions, but they are traveling around Europe, around the world. We had forums in the United States recently, in Japan earlier, and they are talking about this. And this is the one of our tasks, is to deliver this information, you know, to politicians, opinion makers, so that they make corresponding conclusions.
Let's turn a little back to Ukraine, because in a simple sense, if you look at the sort of, you know, the grand strategy, geopolitical view of things, you know, Ukraine is simply fighting for land, resources, etc. And it's looked at in a fairly traditional way. You've got two countries and they're at war, etc., etc. And it seems to ignore the idea that I think Ukraine is fighting for the legacy of Maidan. It's fighting for resurgent democracy, independence, values, identity. It's not simply about land and resources. But there's something else here as well, and you've touched upon it, and this is the extraordinary strength of Ukrainian civil society. And indeed, I always think of this a little bit like a bat in a cave. It's like, you know, the bats live in close proximity, therefore viruses are incredibly virulent, and you've got this incredible arms race between the virus and the immune system of the bat that needs to fight it. It seems to me that Ukraine being positioned next to Russia is in a similar position. You've had to develop resilience on the informational front and now the military front and in politics and against corruption and all these mechanisms that Russia deploys to exert its imperial control. In some ways, it seems that Ukraine has evolved these beyond what we actually have in our Western European societies. So what do you think, you know, do you agree with that process or that summary? And what should the West be learning? Why is it so important for Ukraine to triumph here, for the West to learn from your experience?
You know, I think that the West for so many years had lived in normal life, that they forgot that freedom is not given for granted. That's why, you know, many Westerners did not believe in the war. Many Westerners were trying to, let's say, democratize Russia, to believe in democratic Russia. And they were not understanding, they didn't understand what the freedom is about. Meanwhile, Ukrainians, well, had to fight for freedom all the time. And in the Soviet period, you know, there were mainly groups of in exile who were fighting for collapse of the Soviet Empire, and just like us, you know, talking about the colonization of the Russian Empire today. Then since the independence of Ukraine, well, we didn't have only the Revolution of Dignity. We had three revolutions. One of in the 1990s, which was civil society driven, by the way. The second was the Orange Revolution. Yes, it was like around being united around one leader. But it was not only about, you know, revolution for Yushchenko. He was rather a symbol of freedom, that you cannot violate our rights, you cannot steal our votes from the elections. So, but once again, it was civil society which was playing a key role here. And then, of course, we had Revolution of Dignity, yet another civil society-driven revolution. And immediately after the fall of Yanukovych, because, well, We should remember that the war in Ukraine started not in 2022. It started in February 2014, when Yanukovych and Putin lost Revolution of Dignity. I mean, it was order of pro-Russian President Yanukovych to shoot people on Maidan. I mean, I was there, I saw the bodies, I was building the barricades. I was fortunate not to be one of them, but this was like the first shots of the war were there. Then the Putin invited, when he realized that he is losing Ukraine, he is losing Yanukovych, because you know, if he had Yanukovych under as the president of Ukraine, we would have the same even worse scenario than in Belarus, because you know, well, Lukashenko is an evil, but he is very smart evil, while Yanukovych was very dumb evil. And if he remained in power, Ukraine would be totally controlled by Russia. Putin wouldn't have to invade to you know, on the contrary, he would simply build up his army along with the Ukrainian army to invade later in NATO. That's why I'm telling that the Revolution of Dignity was basically saved the West from the direct confrontation with Russia. And then when we had just, well, we finished the Revolution of Dignity, this is when Putin invaded, Russia invaded in the Crimea, in the Donbas. Our army by that time was almost destroyed. We could not, you know, resist properly, but that's why we had immediately volunteer battalions going to defend the country. And then ultimately we had 2022, when we had basically to fight for our freedom. And what the West can learn is that you cannot have freedom for granted. Because you know, quite often we hear complaints from the West that okay, we have to pay because of this conflict, you have to pay higher gas prices, fuel prices, and so on, and products prices. I mean, I would be happy to pay higher gas prices instead of losing, you know, our best men on the front lines, instead of having so much blood spilled on our front lines.
And the last question here is, of course, a Ukrainian victory is kind of assumed, but when Westerners assume this and policymakers assume it, they don't articulate what needs to happen for that victory to become a reality. In your view, how at risk are the Maidan values? How at risk is Ukraine still? And what do we need to do to ensure that Ukraine holds the line against Russian autocracy and barbarism, which it is clearly trying to expand into the territories of Europe.
We should remember one simple thing, that there are two different approaches to the war tactics between Ukraine and Russia. Russia will send as many people as it needs. You know, we know the numbers today that up to 500,000 of Russians have been liquidated, either killed in action or wounded in their war on Ukraine. And I'm sure Russia will have no problem by finding another 500,000, you know, to send to Ukraine. Because why? For Russia, humans are only means to achieve its political goals. We know many cases, as you know, Russia was sending soldiers as cannon fodder. I mean, I have heard it from my friends on the front lines. They saw it like, you know, just one after another. They are coming as cannon fodder just to take more territories. On the contrary, for Ukraine, as for any other Western country, human being is the most important value. And we cannot simply, you know, send everyone to be killed for the land, for territory. And if you take simple math, you see, well, the numbers are really different. Russia will have much more forces. Then I'm not sure we can win Russia by weapons, because yes, we have huge support from the West. We are really grateful for this. But well, we have Iran, we have Northern Korea, which have basically joined coalition, the new axis of evil led by Moscow. I'm afraid China might join soon openly. So I'm not sure, you know, we will have enough weapons to fight Russia. But at least, you know, the more support we have from the West, it's about, you know, you're not providing us you know, to invade to Russia or something. You are providing weapons to us to save as many lives as possible, as many lives of Ukrainians first, and keep the war going in Eastern Ukraine, not in Eastern NATO countries. So this is the main idea. But whatever happens on the front line, I don't see any prospects, you know, to end this war in a linear way. It's only about when Russia becomes starts, you know, begins this decolonization process, when captive nations starts fighting for their rights. So this is when it can really end.
Well, Taras, it's been a tremendous pleasure speaking to you. Some of these issues, of course, are extremely hard, I think, to wrap our heads around. That's why we'll no doubt do more episodes in future to sort of drill into these in more detail. I think the mechanics of imperialism and how to work back from that and undo it is a topic which I think it's important to cover again from a different angle. But thank you so much for the work you do. I'm going to provide some links to sort of various resources, including an article you've written, plus the interview you did with Joseph Lindsley. We'll put those links into the description of the video. But for today, thanks so much for appearing on Silicon Curtain.
Thank you so much. The pleasure was mine.
Slava Ukraini.
Героям слава.